coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. July is almost over, and that means families need to think about back-to-school shopping and how to stay on budget.
It's a question of now or later, and parents are buying those essentials now, while things like new clothes can often wait.
Contributor Eileen Dalabrida offers a look at what to expect from back-to-school shopping this year. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn what meat breweries are and how Delaware is looking to get in on this emerging business. Arts Playlist takes us to Odessa to check out an exhibition of teapots. And History Matters highlights efforts to restore a historic train in Lewis. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. As July starts to slip away, summer break heads into the home stretch for students. That means families need to start getting the gear kids need for school this fall. What does the current economic climate mean for back-to-school shopping? Are retailers expecting a boost to their late summer sales? And are there deals to be found for families on a budget? Contributor Eileen Dalabrida takes a closer look at the back-to-school shopping landscape in her latest piece, available at DelawarePublic.org. And she recently joined me to discuss what she learned. What are retailers expecting from back-to-school sales this year compared to recent years?
Well, it all depends on which survey you're reading, whether it will decline slightly or more than slightly. The Retail Me Not survey says that parents shopping for grade school and high school students will spend an average of $389 this year, and that's down from $506 last year. It's a pretty significant drop. And for college students, the expected spend is $598 compared to $821. Deloitte's is a little bit more optimistic. It's going to be approximately $570 a student, and that's down $16 from last year, even though prices are a little higher this year.
And I guess a lot of that has to do with the economy these days. And when we talk about that, economists are still keeping a close eye on inflation, as well as the tariffs President Trump continues to threaten to impose. Do we have a sense of how these are affecting prices and back-to-school shopping overall?
Retailers are being very aggressive. Walmart has actually reduced some prices from last year. Target is keeping them the same. I think that, you know, that they're very much aware that the economy is a little iffy, that people are wondering what's going to happen tomorrow because things seem to change from day to day.
So they're trying to find pricing that works for them, but will still draw consumers in. Is that kind of the delicate balance they're trying to do here?
Yes. I mean, a lot of shoppers jumped on those July promotions, Amazon Prime Day, Walmart's big promotion, and they are willing to switch brands if their preferred brand is too expensive. The consumers are being very, very smart and really keeping an eye on what's happening.
So I'm curious, is there a distinction to be made between the, you know, quote-unquote essentials, supplies like notebooks and pens and folders and such, and other items like clothes and shoes, tech, dorm furnishing for college kids? Is there a distinction between those two things when it comes to what we can expect in back to school?
Absolutely. It's a question of now or later, and parents are buying those essentials now, while things like new clothes can often wait.
So in the past, we've seen high costs prompting people to turn to credit cards to get everything they need. Is that something we're also seeing again this year, that people need a little extra help to make sure they get all those things?
Yes, especially credit card programs that allow shoppers to spread their payments out over time without paying interest. And also, Deloitte's survey says that more than a quarter of parents, that's 26% of the folks they surveyed, will buy back-to-school items using cashback websites so that they're actually making those credit cards pay them.
So you mentioned some of the things that some of the bigger retailers are doing earlier. Are there any more specific kind of big sales or deals out there that could help people lower the back-to-school costs?
Well, there are, but most of them are on things that already aren't very expensive. But there are some great deals. Dollar General's, all their core back-to-school items are offered at last year's prices, and that includes Crayola crayons, notebooks, binders, and $1 deals on folders and pencils. Walmart has a very popular promotion. Its Wonder Nation backpack is $4.98. And Target has some great deals, like a 2-pack of Elmer's glue sticks for 50 cents.
Those are not bad. Not bad at all. Speaking of someone who spent the last few years having to buy a lot of those things, any benefit to shopping online versus heading out to an actual brick and mortar store?
Well, convenience is key, which is why 48% of consumers will do at least some of their back-to-school shopping online. It's also very conducive to comparison shopping. You can check within seconds and find out whether Target has a better deal or Walmart. The downside, as always in shopping, is not being able to touch and feel the merchandise, get that absolute in-person accuracy of the color and those kinds of things. Plus the experience of parents and kids shopping together. I spoke with a grandmother in Wilmington who is very much looking forward to shopping for clothes at JCPenney with her granddaughter.
And I guess that goes back to the distinction we made between essentials and some of those other items. I mean, you can order Crayola crayons and folders online, and you don't need to necessarily see them or touch them. But when you're talking about something for a dorm room or clothes or shoes, there is something to be said for being able to try things on or making sure they're just what you're looking for.
Yeah, especially shoes. I mean, and you aren't saving any time if you have to send those shoes back.
So I suppose from what we're talking about so far, these cost concerns could prompt people to put off shopping, hoping for better deals later. But is that a good idea? Is there a chance by buying now you beat any tariff impact that may come down the road? Is that also a delicate balance to maybe make?
It really is a delicate balance. And an NRF survey found that 51% of families started shopping earlier this year, specifically out of concern that prices will rise due to tariffs.
So as we kind of put a bow on all this, we usually talk about back-to-school shopping being something of a harbinger for what to expect from the next big shopping season, and that, of course, is the holiday shopping season. Are retailers keeping a close eye on what we see now with that in mind to maybe understand where consumers' minds are at this point?
I imagine retailers are tearing their hair out, trying to get a handle on what's next. Instead of the traditional pattern that a good back-to-school season is a bellwether of a good holiday shopping season, there's a great deal of uncertainty because of tariffs that may or may not be enacted on August 1st. And toys are a big differentiator between these two most important shopping seasons. Parents don't typically buy toys for school, but they buy lots of them to put under the tree. And most toys are imported traditionally from China. So I imagine we are going to be hearing lots more on tariffs and shopping between now and Black Friday.
Is there anything else you're keeping an eye on as you kind of chart what's going on in the retail space over the next couple of weeks and couple of months?
I'll be keeping an eye on inventory as to whether or not merchants are going to tap the brakes on their orders in anticipation of consumers reining back, or whether or not they have to hit the gas.
It'll be interesting to watch because that certainly would affect consumers. If they hit the brakes, shopping early is probably more important if you want to get what you want.
Indeed.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Dalabrida for joining us on The Green this week. You can check out Eileen's piece on back-to-school shopping right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee introduces us to meat breweries and the cultivated meat they might bring to Delawareans in the next few years. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media.
Listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Abigail Lee. This week, I sat down with Andrew Sales, the co-founder and COO at Livestock Labs, to talk about factory-produced or cultivated meat and potential impacts on the agriculture industry. Can you talk a little bit about where Livestock Labs is right now in terms of their process or its process?
So Livestock Labs was born in May of 2023 by Dr. Uwe when he left his last company, New Age Eats. A few months after, he kind of recruited me away from my last company, Mission Barns, which is the first company in the world to receive regulatory approval for a cultivated pork product. We raised a little bit of money, about close to $500,000 over the course of 2024, allowed us really to get off the ground. So we got a few cell lines from a university partner for cow, pig, and sheep. And then soon after, we then moved to Wilmington. We're now in the midst of engineering those cell lines to give them all the characteristics that are necessary for cultivated meat. So growing meat from cells is not very straightforward. Cells were not meant to grow outside of the animal's body. And so you really need to have these cells be endowed with certain phenotypes or characteristics in order to grow millions of tons of meat at scale economically that deliver on flavor and nutrition. And so Livestock Labs, really what we're trying to bring to the industry is a stable, robust cell line that has all those characteristics.
Okay, so to put that into layman's terms, a cell line in meat production is essentially like the base. It would be like the broth in a soup. Is that accurate?
Think of like, you know, in today's world when we grow meat, you have the, you know, two animals that mate, have an offspring, and then, you know, eventually kind of offsprings come. A cell line is almost like that parent. You put these cells, you know, there's different ways to grow cells. There's different styles of bioreactors. Two of the big ones are kind of like adherent bioreactors, where these cells are, you know, on scaffolds, very similar to how cells might kind of grow on bones. And then there's stir tank reactors, where these cells are kind of floating around in giant bioreactors that you might see in like a brewery. You're putting a couple cells in here, and then over the course of 2 to 4 weeks, those cells are doubling up and filling up those bioreactors.
A bioreactor, in my head, I'm picturing like a sci-fi tank of some kind with tubes everywhere. What does that look like? What is a bioreactor?
It's really an engineered system that allows you to create something. So you could arguably say like a chicken is almost a biological bioreactor for an egg in its sense. So when you think of bioreactor, I think the easiest thing to think about is those giant steel tank, which you might find in breweries, like that is actually brewing our beer or anything fermented. And so it's really just a efficient system that mimics the conditions necessary for whatever you're growing. So one of the promises of cultivated meat is in some ways you're getting a cleaner meat because of this sterile environment from the bioreactor. Conventional meat, you know, when it goes through a slaughter facility, it gets mixed with intestines and feces. Well, with cultivated meat, because it's grown in this sterile bioreactor where you're only growing the critical tissue types that you want, muscle, fat, and connective tissue, is you don't have to cook out any pathogens because there are no pathogens. So you're really getting almost sashimi grade whatever meat you're developing.
Okay, so we have this option of a pathogen-free, I assume antibiotic-free as well, meat. What are the drawbacks? What's the goal here? Is it to replace traditional agriculture, traditional industrial agriculture? Is it to supplement it? And best case scenario, this, you know, type of meat blows up. What happens? What are the effects of it on the industry?
I think in the immediate term, it's going to take a while for cultivated meat to really make an impact compared to conventional meat. So it is supplemental to begin with. You know, right now, meat demand is expected to grow by 70% by 2050. And we simply do not have the land or the water or the planetary resources to really meet that demand as more nations are developing and wanting more meat. And so this is a way to absolutely supplement conventional meat. We're, you know, harvesting meat from an animal that's you know, not necessarily made to feed us. It's just something that we've kind of chosen. But now we could literally design whatever meat we want. We could create a bacon with omega-3 fatty acids instead of trans fat, which right now is known as a group 1 carcinogen, you know, up there with smoking cigarettes. So it's really to deliver a more superior product in a lot of ways. Right now we're, you know, mowing down the Amazon rainforest just to be able to monocrop more soy that then feeds animals so we could rewild more parts of this planet. We don't have to treat animals as poorly as we do right now. There are a lot of farmers doing it right. But in order to meet that demand, there's a lot more intensive factory farms coming up that we really don't have to do if we're growing meat in this manner, as in cultivated meat. The drawbacks are, you know, there's a lot of tradition in meat in every part of it. And so, you know, as times develop, this is very new. I think it's going to be difficult for, you know, people who grew up with conventional meat to make that change. So eventually I do think it will replace it, but only because it's a superior product.
One of the drawbacks with several people that I spoke to was just, I guess, an immediate kind of skepticism toward a meat that doesn't feel natural. Folks have this drawback, but, you know, we have some ethical conundrums in our current industrial agriculture system as well. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how you would talk to someone, how you would approach someone who just doesn't trust the idea of getting their meat in this cultivated way?
It's unfortunate that people don't have that trust, but I think they should be skeptical. I think everybody should be more skeptical of where their food comes from, where their conventional meat comes from, where their conventional seafood comes from, where their vegetables come from. Everybody should ask those questions. Our current system, it's not very transparent. You don't know what cage-free chickens mean. You don't know what free-range chickens means. And you don't know what this new cultivated meat is all about. There's only a few companies that have been approved in the U.S. by the FDA and the USDA. And it is arguably one of the most heavily regulated food products. People should have questions and they should compare one to the other. And they shouldn't, I think, just think that, oh, it's conventional meat. We've been eating this for 10,000 years. It's fine. The conventional meat we're eating today is very different than the meat that was around 10,000 years ago. The chicken looks very different than what it did 50 years ago. So people should be curious. They should be concerned.
I'll just ask directly, is cultivated meat a more ethical choice moving forward?
Oh, that's a tough question. I'm extremely biased, so my one-word answer would be yes. There's a reason why nobody wants to know how the sausage is made and why that's even a saying. I think not allowing cultivated meat to be an option is unethical in the sense that we are running out of planetary resources, and it is, I think, our jobs as humans to kind of, you know, steward the planet in the best way for future generations. And I think knowing everything we do now about conventional meat and what it, you know, can do to the planet, especially if we continue to supply the demand that's coming, is just going to get, you know, worse and worse and worse. And this is an option to move forward. You know, it would be, I think, an equivalent, you know, ethical option if everyone just ate beans and went, you know, vegan and vegetarian. Unfortunately, that's never going to happen. But what you can do, and what I think humans always have done, is put something even better on the table. And I think that's really the promise of cultivated meat, is to put something even better on the table.
Something else that I wanted to touch on was sustainability in terms of land use. You know, I know one of the biggest conversations in talking about climate change is the amount of methane that goes into the air and the atmosphere because of cattle. Can you talk a little bit about how sustainable cultivated meat and cultivated meat production in factories could be compared to, you know, the more traditional route?
Yeah, based on the studies that are out there, it's something like, you know, 90% less greenhouse gases, 90% less land, and like 78% less water. And it's really because we're just hyper-focused in growing exactly what we need in a closed-looped system. So, you know, we don't need to grow the hooves, the beaks, the hair, the feathers, the supporting organs over the lifetime of an animal, which could be up to 2+ years in some cases. We're only growing exactly what we want. Maybe it's just the muscle, just the fat, just the connective tissue. And it is in this closed-loop system. You don't need to mass produce, you know, and monocrop certain products that have, you know, a tough, efficient, like food in versus food out efficiency rate. So for example, the cow that is, you know, farmed intensively requires about 15% of calories in feed input to give you 1 calorie of food in output. And the chicken, the most efficient animal in the world, is about 9 calories in of feed per 1 calorie out as food. Where cultivated meat at even some pilot scale tests is 3 calories in per 1 calorie out. So it's just that the planetary resources are much more minimal for something like cultivated meat, which is why some of the biggest companies in the world are interested in this. So, you know, JBS, Cargill, Tyson, Mitsubishi, these companies are investing in cultivated meat because they know that demand is continuing to rise and they just want to, you know, they want to offer the world protein.
Can you talk a little bit about where funding comes from for specifically livestock labs?
A lot of funding started with investments. So with venture capital investment, angel funding investment, and then a lot of government funding. So we've gotten a lot of government grants as well. The electric vehicle market is somewhere around like $300 billion in the last year. So huge difference in what government funding can do. And I'm optimistic that we are going to see this government funding as I look at cultivated meat and the race for the future of protein, similar to the next space race.
And finally, why Delaware? Why here? And then also, what does your company bring to Delaware?
Never thought I would come out to Delaware. North Carolina sprung up recently as a big hub. I thought that might be a chance from California. But really, it's a matter of chasing funding at an early stage in, you know, states that are going to be very supportive. So California, you know, there are 1 million startups trying to change the world. And so when I met, you know, some representatives from the innovation space, and they offered that they were doing this grant at a beautiful lab space. And they kind of convinced me everything Delaware had to offer, which was, you know, one, a very supportive local and state government, a great community that is big in biotech and life science, where there is talent, which is probably the number one thing we're looking for is as we scale, is there the talent in this area? And Delaware absolutely has that. And where can we, you know, make sure all of our money is really going into R&D and we're not, you know, putting in things we don't have to. In places like San Francisco, it's incredibly expensive just for the rent, to where, you know, you're not putting as much as you'd like into the actual research. And so here we just think we go a lot further. We have a very supportive community and we have the right talent surrounding us to really help build and grow livestock labs for the long term.
Thanks to Andrew Sales for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist, where Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny takes us to historic Odessa for a look at the immense varieties of an object almost all of us have at home, the humble and sometimes not so humble teapot. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media.
Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm Martin Matheny. In this edition of Arts Playlist, I made my way to historic Odessa for a look at the immense varieties of a commonplace object that most of us have at home, the humble and not so humble teapot. It's a hot summer morning in Odessa, but inside the historic Wilson Warner House, the hallway is dark and cool. I'm here to look at the myriad ways craftspeople over the years have turned their artistic talents to one of the most common of objects, something most of us have in our homes. I'm here to look at teapots. Lots and lots of teapots.
There are nearly 250 objects, but teapots alone, nearly 200.
That's Brian Miller, associate curator at the Historic Odessa Foundation. He's going to be my tour guide for an exhibition he curated.
I went back and forth on the title of the exhibit. The exhibit is called My Cup of Tea. I was going to even think of possibly naming it something like, you know, I'm a little teapot short and stout, or, you know, something related to that sort of rhyming story. But I think this title in the end really captures the collector.
They're not all little, short, or stout, but I can verify from firsthand experience that all of the teapots I saw did in fact have a handle and spout. But before we get to looking at the array of teapots, I want to go back to one thing Brian Miller just said, the collector. Every one of the 250 plus objects on display comes from one person's collection.
A friend of mine said, "Wow, I know this lady who has this wonderful collection of teapots. Would you ever want to show it at the museum?" And I was like, wow. So it took a little while, but say 8 months later, I was invited to the collector's house. I looked at the teapots, took pictures, and we definitely wanted to show them for a summer exhibit here in the Wilson Warner House.
Each of the rooms in the house is filled with teapots grouped thematically, Miller explains. To start our tour, we head into the parlor, where Miller has put out a display of English teapots, and here's where one of the few things I know about teapots pops up, Wedgwood.
Right here in the parlor of the Wilson Warner House, we have a wonderful collection of Jasperware teapots, and they are the Wedgwood brand, made right in London. They're just really well known for the wonderful shape, the colors, and the sort of unusual matte finish that's on the outside.
A round table in the center of the parlor is loaded with Wedgwood teapots in lots of different colors. Orange, red, green, black. And on the table, I spot something else Wedgwood is known for. A beautiful shade of blue, maybe a little darker than sky blue.
It's good that you noticed the lighter blue. That's actually even not necessarily copyrighted, but it's known as the Wedgwood Blue.
Over by the parlor wall, Brian points out one of his favorite parts of the exhibition.
The little grouping that's right on the desk represented the United Kingdom, so we have Ireland, Wales, and Scotland represented with a teapot from each location.
The Irish teapot, as you might expect, is covered with delicate shamrocks. The Welsh teapot, as if determined not to be overlooked, is an explosion of color.
So that's called a gaudy Welsh teapot. Uh-huh. So it has a sort of a really orange and blues and greens.
Super
and
bright.
Lusterware sort of finish of the glaze.
And joining Ireland, Scotland, and that very insistent Welsh example is a piece from a place that used to be British, the U.S. Unlike many of the other teapots I've seen, this one is glass, a deep green and elegant swooping shape.
The collector found that one and I think saw it actually hand-blown in Colonial Williamsburg.
Moving across the hallway to the dining room, I'm struck by what would be my favorite part of the whole exhibition. Two large cupboards filled with Art Deco and mid-century modern teapots. They come in all colors of the rainbow, and their forms are sleek and modern-looking.
They're called streamlined, and the coolest thing is they're made along the Ohio River. And I noticed that the collector had collected the most of this style, so this is really her favorite. She loves the 1930s, the 1940s.
Also in the dining room, on a sideboard along the wall, is a collection of exquisite cups, saucers, and, of course, teapots. All a brassy metallic color. In fact, at first, I think they're made of metal. Miller sets me straight.
Yes, definitely of glass and covered with three-dimensional flowers, and I think possibly it's 24-karat gold.
Brian Miller tells me these are special, part of a world-famous glass-making tradition that dates back some 800 years.
All made by the Murano Glass Factory in Venice, Italy. And the collector was there with her husband a few different occasions, vacationing, and they picked up different sets on their visits.
Our tour continues into the kitchen, which is dedicated to Russian and Asian pieces, and into the master bedroom upstairs, where Miller has grouped pieces related to domestic life and the feminine. And across the hall, a fun collection in the kids' room.
I picked her whimsical sort of collection, ones that kids would be able to relate to when they go into that room. There's one in the shape of a blimp, one that's in the shape, two that are in the shape of cars of the time period. Also, there's one that's made of a coconut. There's one that's shell-shaped, and a couple that have children on them, the Hummel sort of style with little children, and even two that are from the World's Fair.
Back downstairs in the dining room, Miller explains that the strength of this exhibit is its diversity.
So we don't just have English or American teapots, but there are Russian-related things. There are Asian-related things, European. So it's really a wonderful collection to see all together.
We've talked a lot about teapots as art, and of course their practical use is apparent as well. But there's another purpose to the humble, or not so humble in some cases, teapot. They were also status symbols.
It could show the taste of the owner. It could show if you're a common person, if you're a more wealthy person. It can show a lot. And I think this collector has really shown that also. It's just amazing to see them all together, isn't it?
And regardless of what you think about teapots as art or status symbols, there's one other thing the teapot does. It brings us together, as it has for centuries.
It's a whole social thing where neighbors, friends would get together, sit around the tea table, talk about their travels, talk about religion, talk about politics, talk about neighbors. And by the way, it's not just for women, it's for everyone.
Think about these teapots not as artifacts, but as a thread running through history, connecting people like us with, well, people like us over the years.
I think they'll be able to identify with them because basically everyone should have some kind of a teapot, coffee pot, whether it's sitting on their stove, it's sitting in their kitchen or living room or whatever.
And that brings us squarely back to the dark, cool hallway at the Wilson Warner House and to the title of this exhibition, My Cup of Tea.
I'm hoping that a little girl or a little boy or someone will just really be able to identify with the wide variety of teapots and find one that they just really love.
In short, their cup of tea. For Delaware Public Media, I'm Martin Matheny in Odessa. And the Green continues in a moment with History Matters and more on an effort in Lewis to restore a historic steam locomotive as a nod to the area's railroad heritage. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media.
Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Joe Irizarry. The Lewis Junction Railroad and Bridge Association recently announced that the historic steam locomotive number 60, which was initially built for the Pennsylvania Railroad, is going to be restored for display in Lewis with the goal of it being ready for next summer. In this edition of History Matters, David Ludlow, who was on the board of directors with the Lewis Junction Railroad and Bridge Association, joins me to discuss. David, first, can you please tell us about the Lewis Junction Railroad and Bridge Association? It's a relatively new organization. How was it formed, and what's the mission of the organization?
Well, the LJRBA, Lewis Junction Railroad Bridge Association, was started when the state of Delaware decommissioned the rail line from Georgetown to Cape Henlopen State Park. The state of Delaware had done a lot of installation of bike trails and rails with trails, and so what happened was the city entered into a memorandum of agreement with us. We formed a nonprofit to interpret the railroad history for the town of Lewis and even for a larger, for Sussex County also. So the LJRBA's first mission was to save the big railroad swing bridge over the Lewis-Rehoboth Canal, which we were able to do. And it is on display alongside the bike trail right in downtown Lewis. It's actually on American Legion Road. You can see the bridge. Our next mission was to relocate the track away from the bike trail so that we could display our rolling stock inventory that we had collected and would be collecting to interpret the importance and some of the historical artifacts for a display in downtown Lewis. The track was moved. Our first display piece came in, which is a 1917 caboose. It was cosmetically restored on the interior and exterior, was painted and numbered accurately to the Pennsylvania Railroad's original design. And then we had a tender made, which is a coal and water cistern to carry behind a steam locomotive, which is our next big endeavor.
Sussex County has a rich history as it pertains to railroads. Can you briefly touch on it?
Sure. So interestingly, I mean, it is very, very historic. When picture this is with the early part of the century, and there is a lot of produce. There are peaches. There are melons and oysters and things like this that are all in the area, but you can't get them to market. So the farmers in Sussex County were very glad to see when a rail line connected the western part of the county to the shoreline at Cape Henlopen, and produce and vegetables that were grown in the county then had a great way to get to market. They were put on the train actually ran out onto piers out into the Delaware Bay, and then you could put them on steamer boats and run them to Cape May, Philadelphia, and New York. All of a sudden, the agricultural industry got very busy because you had a big, big market. And there's some wonderful pictures that you can find where they're loading on boxes and boxes and crates of melons, tomatoes, oysters, things like this, to ship to the markets up in the Northeast United States.
Historic steam locomotive number 60. It's going to be cosmetically restored for display in Lewis. What is the historical significance of this particular locomotive?
Okay, so yes, we're very fortunate to have this machine donated to us. It is, without getting very technical, it is a steam locomotive that was built in 1913. And this machine has a wheel arrangement of what's called an 060, which means it has six driving wheels with no wheels leading and no wheels trailing. So the 060 switcher of number 60, built in 1913, weighs 88 tons, and was donated to us. And it is a Pennsylvania Railroad machine. And as part of our display, we're trying to interpret the Pennsylvania Railroad, which operated the line here in Lewis. And it fits perfectly. It happens to be the last known example of its particular wheel arrangement and boiler arrangement that is still exists. So we have the last of this configuration, and it's very important that we, protect it, preserve it, interpret it, and bring it into town for everybody to see. It's the last one.
As for the restoration, what needs to be done?
Okay, so the locomotive. Here are the steps. The locomotive is currently in Wilmington. We do have title to the machine, and what we have done is contracted with a firm that's in the industry that does these types of things all over the United States. They not only move them, they cosmetically restore them, and they also restore them for operation in Tourist Line Railroad. So we have to dismantle this in order to transport it, because again, it's very tall and it has a whole lot of weight. And to be able to move it, we're going to actually take the running gear or the wheels and frame, and we're going to take that off, and the boiler is going to be separated. And then we can put it on two trucks, bring it to Lewis, put it on the panel track that we have where our display is, reassemble those pieces, and then finish the cosmetic restoration of the outward appearance and appliances, the smokestack, the headlight, the cab, the running gear, the side rods. These are all parts to the machine that make it look complete. So we will do that once we have moved it to Lewis and we'll get ready to display it. I should note that our focus is now as part of Lewis's, the town of Lewis's 250th celebration next year, the semi-quincentennial. We hope to have locomotive number 60 as one of the big crown jewels and big showpieces for that 250th celebration of the United States of America.
So when you have the restoration and you have it ready to go, it's essentially going to look like if we saw it back in 1913 or, 100 years ago now?
For the most part, yes, it will. For the most part, yeah. Some parts and things like this are so badly deteriorated, and it will simply be a matter of funding and budgeting to how far we can go. For example, do we want to put every last little appliance underneath that was there when it was new, or if we have representation of it, or we can, document it in some way, that may be good enough. So it will be pretty close for the for most visitors to look at and marvel as this is a steam engine that was 1913 design, and this is what it looked like. Can you actually go up and say, well, this would have been a little bit different, or this would a little bit indifferent? Sure, sure. But that's just a matter of cosmetic restoration. To the casual visitor and the pedestrians and the bicycles that use the trail right alongside the locomotive, yes, it'll appear as a ready-to-go steam locomotive.
That's awesome. Can't wait to see when it's up there. That's going to be great. You gave us the end of the timeline when you want it to be up and ready for display. When does that work? When does all of that getting to that point start? Has it started already?
We expect that where we are today, again, the locomotive is currently in Wilmington, and our contractor will start. It has not started yet as of this date in July. We expect that they will be visiting the site to assess their actual plan of attack to see what needs to be done and how they will disassemble it and what parts will come off and be shipped to be refabricated off-site or from another vendor. That will be taking place, I assume, pretty much late July into August and September. And then if things are good, we can finish some of the basic disassembly up in Wilmington and start to bring the machine down and reassemble the basic components. Probably, I'm going to say, this fall when it starts to cool down, and then work on it down here to finish those cosmetic restorations. And as we start to come out of the winter and the spring, hopefully we're coming down the wire with it sometime in the spring and early summer.
How exciting is it for the LJRBA to add this particular piece to your collection?
It's very exciting. It's very exciting because, again, many people don't realize that this is the last one. There are no other ones that we are familiar with that are even in existence with this particular configuration. Now, there was one just recently, I mean, within literally months, that was restored at the Railroad Museum of Pennsylvania that looks like the same identical piece of equipment, but underneath ours is different than theirs. So it's very exciting. I hope people really, you know, listen to this story and realize that, you know, saving the last one of these is a pretty big deal. And the LJRBA is kind of new at this business, but we've got some very good, dedicated people. And these people are committed to doing it right and doing it properly in a fashion that is you know, pays respect to the piece of equipment. You know, 1913, 88 tons. It's a big undertaking. And so we find it to be, we're all excited about it. And I think a lot of the community is excited. We have open houses on weekends, certain periods during the weekends. And when people come by, they are as excited as we are to think about the possibilities of seeing that machine sitting there on the tracks and, you know, being able to walk right up next to it, touch it, look at it, take pictures with it. We have a very, very large contingent of people that are supporters, that are behind us. But I will say that we are still actively fundraising. We are starting down the pipeline, but we are still actively fundraising to complete all of the restorations that we have planned for it.
Where can people go to find out more about the LJRBA?
So, yeah, the LJRBA can be found Lewis Junction Railroad Bridge Association. You can find us on our Facebook page, but we also have a website. And for those of your listeners that would like to visit the website, learn a little bit more about us, get some history, the website is lewisjunctionrr.org. And for those that would like to assist in supporting this project, you can do so at the website or on the Facebook page. And every little bit helps. We're looking down the end of the tunnel. We see the light at the end of the tunnel, but we're not quite there. And we want it to be really the best we can do.
Thanks to David Lutlow for helping showing us why history matters.
And that brings us to the finish line for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, contributor Eileen Dalabrida and Delaware Public Media's Joey Irizarry, Abigail Lee, and Martin Matheny. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.